I was at the airport last night and had an opportunity to jot down some questions, none of which these folks have seen yet. So this is live, right? This is live. Now, they're friendly questions, and I'm actually going to begin, Jessica, if I may, with you, just as you will for us. For some of us, the language or the term apologetics is still rather slippery, maybe intimidating. Help us to think about what apologetics is, what it involves.
Sure. Well, when we're thinking about apologetics, a lot of times we start with a verse in 1 Peter 3, where Peter tells us that to give a reason for our faith. So it's basically, and for the hope that we have. So really we're just looking to share with other people, why do we hope in Jesus? And it's really that simple.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to pass the mic to Dick. And I'm just going to ask you, Dick, this question. In Le Brie, for many years and in various conferences like this, you've done a lot of teaching and writing on apologetics. You, I think, would agree with Oz Guinness, who sees this as the grand age of apologetics in terms of opportunity, materials, and so forth. And yet we don't always seem to be making much of a dent. What are we doing wrong? What's wrong with our apologetics?
I thought Mark was my friend. I think apologetics has a bad name for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes good reasons because of what people have seen, and sometimes bad reasons because apologetics, the idea, stands against relativism, that is the drift of the time. I think it can be locked in an academic context, let me start. First of all, the most important person to do apologetics with is yourself. If you don't really believe it yourself, you're faking the rest of it, okay? And so we do need to deal with our own doubts, beliefs, and so on, but then we need to get past that and really connect with other people, not just with what we think they ought to be thinking, or the way we think they can be challenged, but by really interacting with them, a two-way street. And I think there's a lack of that. That's what Schaefer was so very good at. Not just sitting in a library cranking out books, but talking one-on-one, back and forth. And that involves, I'll be talking tomorrow about the little passage in 2 Corinthians 10, two sides, a negative side and a positive side, that must be the destroying obstacle to the proud knowledge of God and making every thought captive to Christ, the negative and the positive. And we need enormous, and this is where the theme of this weekend is important, imagination to do that with sensitivity. And how we do that, we need to be with people who are doing that, see people, listen to people doing it, and learn how to listen, how to suss out what are questions I can ask that are going to connect with the obstacles that are in the way of the knowledge of God in this person. And so I guess I'm somewhat... working in Le Brie, where we're spending our time doing is living together with people. So there's a lot of informal time and a lot of just that invites interaction. I'm sort of prejudiced toward that as a really central part of it. But if we don't have that, I think we're in trouble. It can be the idea of apologetics can be an abstract sort of a discipline rather than a way of really connecting with real live people who are sitting next to us.
Thank you. I'll ask you that to Dennis. Dennis, you and Margie, who's here with you for many years, have ran Ransom Fellowship, and you've published a magazine that many of us here at Covenant Seminary benefit from and read, Critique Magazine. Dennis also has a very robust website of book reviews, film reviews, cultural thought pieces. But Dennis, here's a question for you. In so much of your publication and your ministry, you don't use the word apologetics as much as you use the language or the term of discernment. Ransom Fellowship wants to help Christians discern. Can you help us think about discernment as a mode or as a part of apologetics?
Yeah. And if you haven't decided to come, I'm going to be showing film clips. So if that helps. If that helps. One of the things that Marge and I have been very concerned about right from the very beginning is that it seems to us, and it's only increasing as we are in this time of political and economic and social insecurity in our society, where racial tensions are increasing and all sorts of other fault lines are appearing. It seems to us that a lot of Christians tend to be somewhat reactionary or defensive in their posture with the surrounding culture. And what we have wanted to do is to try to equip them with a way in which they can intelligently and with substance apply the truth of the gospel to the issues that are surrounding them without being reactionary or defensive, but instead being able to winsomely commend the gospel of Jesus Christ. It seems to me that we have the best story that ever came down the pike. The story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration applies to every aspect of life and culture. And therefore, we can have something that is imaginative and positive and good to say, and at times taking apart wrong ideas, absolutely, in order to speak the truth into that setting. I liked what Dick said when he mentioned listening. It seems to me that that's a skill that we have to learn. Margie and I discovered early on that we thought of ourselves as very good listeners, even when we were talking. And we had to discover what it meant to be quiet, to let the conversation go, and in that moment, trust the Holy Spirit of God to be at work, even though it felt like in that moment we were losing control because the other person was talking. I prefer to talk because then I'm in control and I can say where it's going next. If I let you talk, who knows where you will take it? Who knows? And so actually having to walk by faith in that moment is a learning experience. And yet it seems to me that is part of what we're talking about. These aren't just ideas. They're also how we live and how we interact with people, just as Jesus did.
Thank you. As the
quick footnote.
Yeah, please.
Just one thing. In this passage on 2 Corinthians, he says, destroying arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God. All sorts of stuff that are not arguments. In other words, what are obstacles to the knowledge of God? Possessions, people, heroes, values, zillions of things, and we need to listen to know that and not just assume it's all a question of arguments.
Wonderful. As the microphone comes to Jessica, I'm just going to ask you, it was just fortuitous, it came your way. We're beginning to hear a picture of apologetics that certainly includes what we most think of in terms of arguments and speaking a word back. We're starting for it to broad out a little to include the act of discernment. And as Dick has just helpfully reminded us, every proud obstacle. I want to just pivot a little bit, Jessica, and help us to think now about this other piece of our conference, imagination. What is the imagination? What business does it have tracking about with apologetics?
That's great. I'm so excited that we're talking about this because we really can, in apologetics, become so focused on rational argument, giving proof, evidence, things like that. And C.S. Lewis talked about the imagination a lot, and as we know, he was a great apologist. But, you know, we tend to think of imagination as telling a story, making up, you know, writing fiction, or creating something artistically, and certainly all of those things are imaginative. But he talked about the imagination as really a faculty of the way that we think, and we need it even in order to be able to reason. So imagination is what allows us to attach a meaning to something. It's all of our memories, all these pictures in our minds are stored in our imagination, and when we encounter something, we are going to immediately access things from our imagination
to discern what it means. So a word like God will have a certain meaning for some people that maybe isn't necessarily how we're thinking about it when we're trying to share our faith. And so their imagination is going to need to be reshaped in a sense to give the correct meaning for God before we can really reason about God or talk about, is he real? What does relationship with him look like? All of that requires us to access our imagination. And so it's not only an important piece of, you know, or a good piece to add to apologetics, but it's really necessary if we're going to get to that point where we can reason about God together.
So just to piggyback there, if I can, you're suggesting that by emphasizing or giving space to the imagination, we're not really taking away or dismissing the intellect.
Right. Yeah, not at all. C.S. Lewis would say it's a necessary antecedent to the intellect to even to be able to reason. We have to be talking and mean the same thing about what we're talking about if we're going to be able to reason about it.
Right. And just maybe as a concrete illustration very quickly, do not put your hand up in what follows, okay? But this is a rhetorical question. Don't put your hand up. How many of you have been drunken sailors? And yet we just sang about that, didn't we, in our worship to the Lord. Somehow that language, that image connected with us, it meant something. It helped us to appreciate the way in which the grace of God has come down to us, even in the depths of our brokenness, our rebellion, and so forth. So it actually facilitated understanding. It didn't detract, compete, or so forth. Dick, if I can come back to you, you gave a lecture that was very helpful to me on Jesus as an imaginative apologist. For some of us, that strikes us sideways. We won't mention any names. An individual, very well known in the apologetics world, wrote a book called The Apologetics of Jesus, in which Jesus was an expert at Venn diagrams and the law of non-contradiction and Thomas's five ways. I don't think that's what you mean by the apologetics of Jesus. Help us for a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess the imagination to me is, I mean, if I describe to you the color of the carpet, I don't need any imagination to do that. It's observing, it's recording my observation. Almost everything else we do with our consciousness requires imagination. Getting out of bed in the morning. Why do you do it? Because you have an imaginative picture of what's going to happen that day. Or at least you have an imaginative picture of what would happen if you don't get out of bed that day. And that's all stored up in your imagination from past experience, from memory, and from projection into the future. All that is imagination. So it's reaching out beyond just the factual world or the world of logical deduction. And it's going beyond the prosaic and the flat-footed. I love to give Jesus' example. I've done a lot with Jesus' questions. And if you look in Matthew 21, where they come to Jesus and they ask him, what gives you the authority to do these things, meaning miracles, meaning proclaiming all sorts of radical things, what would be a flat-footed, prosaic answer? He could have said, well, I'm God. But how absolutely unlike Jesus that would have been. Everybody giggles because it would be just unthinkable that Jesus would have said, I'm God. He was God. So it wasn't because that wouldn't be true, but he realized that if he'd done that, his imagination, he didn't want to just give correct answers. He wanted to help these people. He wanted to lead them toward being able to really believe in him and trust in him. And so he says, let me ask you a question. And you answer that, then I'll answer this question. Of course, he leads them into what's the authority behind John the Baptist's baptism, and they can't answer it because they're afraid to answer it because they don't dare expose what they really believe is that John the Baptist isn't from God. They knew that the people love him, so that would get them huge resistance, and so they say, well, we don't know. We don't really know, which they do know. At least they know what they think. And they are exposed, and then Jesus exposes that. He says, you know perfectly well what you think. And so he exposes them to themselves. He doesn't just give a correct answer to the question they asked. He gives them a picture of themselves as spin doctors rather than religious leaders, and also helps the people see them as spin doctors rather than religious leaders. So he does what I think is such an important part of apologetics, is not just talk about God, but who are you? You need to understand yourself better to get a hold of the gospel before you'll be really hungry for the gospel. So Jesus' imagination and a thing like that is just limitless when you think of where he was going, what he could have gone in a flat-footed way but didn't.
Dennis, if I can come to you again, one of the other aspects of Jesus' apologetics, as you know well, is he loved to tell stories. He loved to paint the world in such a way that aimed into the teeth of the imagination and provoked and connected. You do a lot with film, and over your time with us this weekend, you're going to talk about film. How does film and storytelling fit into the task of apologetics?
Yeah, I think it's right central to it. Everyone has a story. Everyone lives in a story, and everyone is shaped by stories. In fact, human life and existence is utterly inexplicable apart from story, it seems to me. We in the Reformed world love the Book of Romans, but we can't possibly understand what Paul is arguing for in that exquisite book if we don't know the Old Testament, if we don't know the story of redemption as God has worked it through history and ultimately in Jesus Christ. It seems to me that when Jesus told stories, when he told his parables, it was like he was planting. Have you ever gotten one of those little splinters under your fingernail, and at first you can't get it out? It's just there. And then 2 days later, you realize it's starting to hurt and so on. It's just embedded underneath, and it just sort of keeps reminding you that it's there. And I think that Jesus' parables were a lot like that for his hearers. He told his story. Okay, son ran away from home. Fed pigs. Yeah, okay. And then several days later, you're still thinking about that. Which brother am I most like? What's really going on here? It seems to me that his use of story was absolutely brilliant in helping people face themselves, face the truth, and ultimately face God himself. And in film, we have, and real creative TV, I'm sort of lumping them together and calling it film, those are the premier storytelling arts in our culture today. And if we want to know what our neighbors are thinking, we want to know something of what Charles Taylor calls their social imaginary that is shaped by stories, that often comes through film. It often comes through film today. It's the stories that shape our ideas. It's the stories of film that make things plausible. And of course, in a broken world, sometimes that's for blessing and sometimes it's for curse. Okay? Stories can make implausible and incredible things seem both plausible and credible. And that's where the whole process of discernment comes in. Nevertheless, in these stories that are in our culture, we see all the great questions being explored, the great questions that philosophy and religion and all the rest have always addressed, that the yearnings in the heart of mankind and humankind. So it seems to me that as we hear these stories and interact with people, we gain entrance into their hearts to some extent, into their hearts. And if we are safe people so that they can actually talk about those things, then I think those stories sometimes open the door to talking about the greatest story of all in ways that are appropriate as it intersects with what that film is about.
I'm going to ask you to bring the microphone up this way to Jessica. We're going to give to Jessica our final question. As it turns out, Jessica, you and Zach are currently teaching a class on communicating with the apologetic sensitivity of Jesus. Some of you in this room are in that class learning to communicate in that way. But just round us out. We've got a better picture now of what apologetics is, what it involves. We're beginning to understand the role of imagination, and Jesus is an imaginative apologist. How do we learn to be sensitive in our apologetics. Just give us a couple of takeaways for this morning.
Sure. Well, I think that's some things that that Dick and Dennis have already pointed out, just about being willing to listen, to try to communicate imaginatively with someone in a way that a meaning will connect with them or something that will resonate for them, that you can then connect to God. You have to know them. You have to listen to them and try to understand, well, what do they mean by this word when they're using it? How is it different from me? So we have to slow down instead of use our, you know, silver bullet argument that we think will work on everyone. We have to actually understand, what do they need to hear? What's missing for them? It requires us to humble ourselves, like they said, and give up control of the conversation, and be willing to just pray as we're talking, trying to listen, trying to be sensitive maybe to what pain they might have had in the past, that an example we might use might push on and hurt. So we try to avoid that or maybe go somewhere else, try to listen. And ultimately, yeah, I think it just depends on praying and asking God, whatever we're offering, please use this in their lives.
Thank you. Well, I promised you at the very start this was intended to whet your appetite, give you a taste. I don't want to overfeed you. We want you to come back tonight for more. So join me in thanking our guests, if you would.